Oh, recording.
Please.
Yep. Okay. Very good. Okay. Well, welcome back, or welcome if you have come for the first time. And if you did miss last time, you might want to catch up on the recording sometime. This is a series, and last time we looked at basically what a rabbi was, what a disciple was all about, and how the two related, because that's going to be important background to a lot of what we do, as we, as the title says, listen to the Jewish Jesus. So a lot of the time he was obviously teaching his disciples. And then we looked at three particular, a short passage with three incidents in it about calls to discipleship and responses to it, and looked at some of the idioms and strange phrases that Jesus used on that. So for tonight, I'm picking up something specific to the rabbi side of it. Some more passages to do with the discipleship side of it. And then if we've got time, which I think we might have, a separate but not unrelated item. So the first topic is the matter of authority, because this is one area where Jesus stood out from all the other teachers of the time. And we'll pick up some verses to start with. You're probably familiar with this, but if you want to check it out, at the end of Matthew 7, when Jesus has finished that initial teaching on the Sermon on the Mount, as we call it, then at the end of Matthew chapter 7, and it's also recorded in a couple of other places, in other Gospels, in other words, it says the crowds were amazed because he taught as one who had authority. And then it adds, as not as their teachers of the law. So that's one reaction that people had. The crowds had that reaction when they heard him. They were amazed, which actually wasn't what Jesus was aiming for. That's not the whole point of him teaching, get people going, ooh, how wonderful. But they picked up something about his authority that was different. And there's another group which also picked up about his authority. And I'd like to find that in Matthew 21 and verse 23. Matthew 21, 23. I'll tell you the other references as well, just for completeness, but it's also in Mark 11, 28. But I don't think it's any different. Mark 11, 28 is the same, and Luke 20, verse 2. I imagine that would be identical as well. Yeah, it's the same two questions from the same group of people. So I'm still looking now at Matthew 21, 23. And now we've got the religious leaders, the chief priests, the elders of the people, and they are quite concerned. Their questions are based not out of amazement, but more out of worry and concern. And they're asking genuine questions here. They wanted the answers. By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you that authority? These were very important questions to them, the reasons that we're going to talk about. So the question that they asked is an important one. Where did Jesus actually get his authority from, and what did it really mean? So something that we looked at last time was that before AD 70 and the destruction of the temple and the move away from Jerusalem and redefining of Judaism from that point onwards, that was when there was the official formal title of rabbi. Whereas before then, therefore in Jesus' time, we said that there were teachers who just carried this informal title of rabbi out of popular respect. But there was a convention amongst those who taught, and indeed those who listened, because it was important to prevent anybody just teaching whatever they wanted. So if you were going to go about teaching, you were constrained by what had come before and what you had learned. And therefore, you are expected to teach in the name of those who had taught you. So, in the name of your rabbi, or even those who had taught him. So, most religious teaching of the day was based upon the tradition of quoting other rabbis. So typically, someone might say that Rabbi X following Rabbi Y following Rabbi Z said, and so on. And that might seem very second-hand and even a rather stale way, perhaps, of passing on teaching. But it showed firstly that you'd learnt your stuff. You were part of this. You weren't just making it up. And it wasn't just your own opinion. So there was a sort of chain of authority that people expected to hear. And you were only allowed to teach something new if you had been sort of authorized to do that. And it's a bit vague, I think, as to how that happened. But if two teachers that already were authorized to be able to say something new recognize any someone else, then they were sort of authorized them. But otherwise, your authority came directly from those who had taught you. And that's what's going on in this question of the chief priests and the elders. They really needed to know who had authorized Jesus to say these things. Where are you getting all this from? Is there anybody else around saying the same sort of things? And this bit about keeping control, really, by the looks of it, because they were concerned. It wasn't the normal sort of thing. So these two reactions, one from the crowd who were very pleased because Jesus taught them differently and they recognized his authority, and we'll see how in a minute, and the leaders who were a bit more bothered about what this really meant, who had authorized him, and if not, wasn't anybody, what was going on. So the next thing I want you to read is, if you're Matthew 21, read the rest of that little section from verses 24 to 27. And just to give my voice a rest, tell me what you make of what happens then. Jesus is asked these questions and he replies in verses 24 to 27. So you come in with some questions or comments or thoughts about what's actually going on in the rest of that section. If you can raise your hand when you're ready, that helps, because there's a couple of screens and I've got a couple of co-hosts looking out for you. Basically, what I'm asking, oh, we've got two people. Yes, go on then. However, John and Rose.
It's just so Jewish that he would answer a question with a question.
Oh yeah, good point. Yeah, just about to come in. Do you think he actually answered the question? And you picked up the first point on that. Good. Jackie?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Okay. But he didn't sort of, well, what kind of question did he ask them, do you think? What was he actually doing at this point? Well, we've got two people now. So there's two Johns here. We'll go for John and Jan first of all.
I think he's trying to get the teachers of the time to argue with each other because he knew finding the question he asked was controversial.
Yes, good point. You're right. Yeah, he's asked a challenging question, so he throws a challenge back at them. And you're quite right. What about John and Rose again?
I was thinking he was trying to establish his own authority by challenging them to think, well, where did John get his authority? Why weren't they asking him? But I like John Hall's answer. Just
Yeah,
what Paul
okay.
did with the Sanhedrin, get them fighting among themselves.
Yeah, who else we got? Mary?
I thought it was a trick question because he knew they couldn't answer it.
Right, okay, good point. We got John and Jan again.
Was he trying to link himself with John?
Yeah, that's a good point. Why not? Yes, I mean, he didn't just pick John out at random in that sense. Yes, do you know, there's some people I've heard it said, and I'm not really too sure on this, but that maybe Jesus learned from John. John was his authority, as though. you know, John had some teaching influence over Jesus to start with, but I've not really come across that in any serious way. But of course, John was another maverick, if you like. So it's a good reason why he would pick him out. But as you say, he sent a challenge back and he's got them stuck. Because as it says, what could they say? If they said one thing, then like, you know, oh, it's from God, then they're condemning themselves for not believing him. And if they say it's from men, well, they knew it wasn't from men, i.e. John also wasn't in their system. John also didn't go round quoting rabbis and he hadn't come through the ranks, so to speak. So when Jesus asked, was it from heaven or was it from men? That's when they were really, really stuck. So what is their answer in the end? It's the very lame verse 27. We don't know. We don't know. In other words, I can't answer this. And that allows Jesus brilliantly to sidestep the issue and they sort of have to drop the whole matter. Anyway, we can do better than we don't know because Jesus had received authority. Where do you think he actually got his authority from?
His father.
His father, yeah. And is there any good evidence for that?
Well, it says throughout scripture that he didn't do anything or say anything without the father's authority.
Indeed, yeah. And we'll look at one or two of those verses in a minute. But what about earlier?
What about John's baptism?
Yeah.
Yes, you mean that Jesus' actual baptism, but where John was there? Yeah,
sorry. Yeah.
Yes, because actually that was the point in which there was this authority given him by two people, if you think about it, if you want to sort of push that analogy. He was authorised by the fact that the Spirit came upon him and also the Father spoke.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Father spoke again at the Transfiguration, and the voice from heaven, and this time God added, the Father said, listen to him, which I think is very significant. And then you get the statement in John 3:2, when Nicodemus comes along, and I think we mentioned this last time, but just to emphasize the key point here, Rabbi, we know you are a teacher who has come from God. So, we know it. And how do we know it? Well, no one could perform the miraculous signs you're doing if God were not with him. So he was being authenticated and authorized, and it was recognized by, in this case, Nicodemus, because of what he was doing as well. His actions also backed up his words. But just to underline what was said a moment ago about Jesus' own testimony, was, and you can find this in several places in John, so I'll just read a bit out. I'm not here on my own, but he who sent me is true. You do not know him, but I know him because I am from him and he sent me. And lots of statements where Jesus is actually saying my testimony is from the Father. So I'm picking out another one in John where he says, yes, the words I say unto you are not just my own. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. In the famous prayer in John 17, he says, for you, the Father, you have granted him authority over all people that he might give eternal life, and so on. So that was why the crowds would be amazed, because they recognised an authority. That's why the other leaders would be a bit worried, because they were thinking, ah, there is something here, but we don't seem to have a sort of handle on this to know what to do with it. But it was very different from the other rabbis, because Jesus did not go around quoting other rabbis. And I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that in the Sermon on the Mount, time and again, Jesus says, but I tell you. You have heard it was said, but I'm not going to tell you what it's been. Well, I'm not going to talk about what's been said. I'm going to tell you something new. So you know all this, And I'm not just repeating the other rabbis, but I tell you. And you'll find that happens five times in Matthew chapter 5. And the only time you could use that phrase, but I tell you, as I've said, as if you had special authority to be able to add something new. So Jesus is operating as though he's got authority, but no one knows from that point of view where it came from. No one had passed on to him what he was telling them. And so his listeners were sort of astonished a little bit, like, well, does he have this authority? Yes, it sounds great. He must have. But it was a bit unusual. Now, the other thing that's worth pointing out, unless there's anyone want to make, do you want to comment at this point, anyone, before I keep going? It's all on this same theme. We've got three people want to come in. Okay, I saw Lynn coming in first, I think. So shall we do Lynn?
I am aware that you're talking about Jesus and his authority to teach, but have you considered verse 12, that the, because it says he was teaching, but when the the chief priests and the elders of the people confronted him, verse 23, do you think they could also be querying why Jesus had drove out those who bought and sold in the temple, querying his authority to do that as much as
the authority to teach. Fair point. Which chapter are you in, though? Because you just
gave was Matthew 23 I initially read from.
Oh, okay.
Referring back to Matthew 20. Oh, no, I beg your pardon. Matthew 21, verse 23. Referring back to Matthew 21, verse 12.
Yes, okay, because you're quite right. By what authority are you doing these things?
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying. They would also be bothered about not just what he was saying, but what he was doing, particularly there. Yeah, good. Thank you. I think Jackie might have been next.
I was just going to say the I Ams and John. I mean, there's actually 17 of them, not just the normal sort of 7 or 8 that people think.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I've done a wee study on this, but I mean, there's two times that it says, I and my Father are one. I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. You know, so there's really strong evidence in John's Gospel throughout it with these 17 I Ams.
Yeah, good. John and Rose again.
Yeah, just to say that in a kind of way, stepping back a bit to verses 26, 27, whatever, the rabbis are therefore condemning themselves as well, effectively, by not saying, oh, you're from God. Okay, they perhaps they had some uncertainty at that point, but nonetheless, they showed their colours.
Yeah. Okay, I think we have Pat somewhere, Pat Baird.
It's to do with Matthew, with Isaiah 11. When he's talking about the branch will emerge from the trunk. And it says, the spirit of Adonai will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding. Mm-hmm. So at the baptism, they would have recognized that.
Yeah. And you could say that lots of the Old Testament scriptures also add to his authority as well. But that, yeah. Okay. One more then. Elaine, I think. Oh, there's two. Elaine and then maybe more.
It's more the fact that Jesus would have obviously been versed in the law and the prophets. And therefore, how, you know, would that have also added to the scribes and Pharisees' confusion? Would they would have known that Jesus would have been versed in that and adding something?
Yeah, you're right. There's plenty of evidence for them to have come to the same conclusion. But some of them obviously didn't want to recognize him and therefore wanted to question everything, including his authority. So, yeah.
And obviously would it have been variable who in the crowd, some in the crowd may have known, some others in the crowd wouldn't have known about Jesus.
Good point. Yeah, it's a very general statement, isn't it? And so.
Right.
Thank you. I saw, Rhian. You have to unmute, please.
Hello, thank you. For me, the noticeable thing, as well as what people have said, is the rabbis questioning him were merely men. Jesus was both God and man.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, his deity gave him the authority.
Yeah. And that's really tied up in these verses in John, where he says, you know, I am the Father is living in me, I am the Father and one, and so on. So that's, it's not just sort of an external thing, you're quite right. It's to do with, and therefore that's why he was doing what he did. So, okay, let's just keep moving on this. I just want to point out something else that at the beginning of Matthew 5, another aspect of how his authority is portrayed here is when it says in verse 1, he sat down. And that's how Matthew introduces this collection, this compilation of Jesus's early teaching. He actually wants us to realize that even though in real life he probably said it all over the place many times, walking around and so on, at this point Matthew is saying he sat down. And you probably know that that rabbis generally sat to teach. It's rather unusual actually, because of the old Zoom thing. I'm actually sitting to teach, but normally people stand, don't they, to speak. But by actually saying, stressing, if you like, that he's sat to teach, it is now you listen carefully to him, because he is about to deliver something important. This is specifically about discipleship. If you want to follow him, if you want to become a disciple, then this is the moment when you need to listen carefully. And do you know, there's two other places where Matthew says the same thing about Jesus, where he sat to teach. So I'm going to quiz you on that for a little while, until I tell you. Did you know the two other occasions when it says that Jesus sat to teach?
Once in the synagogue at Nazareth.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, okay. That's probably more in Luke than Matthew, but yeah, good, you caught me out there. That's another one, effectively. He would have sat to teach at that point. But I'm thinking more of him sort of out in the open doing his other sort of rabbi stuff.
Was it in the boat?
Yes, okay. Which, do you know his chapter?
No.
Okay, anyone want to help out there?
How do you... Matthew
13, yeah. Okay, it says he sat by the lake, but then I think he says he got into a boat and sat in it. Now, if you think about that chapter, this is the chapter full of parables. This is another major teaching chapter. And Matthew again wants us to realize that he is now sitting in order to deliver something of authority. And anyone know the other one?
Was it not when the Sermon on the Mount?
Well, that's the one I just talked about.
Oh,
so
sorry.
I'm going to the third one. We've got chapter 5, we've got chapter 13. There's another mount, actually, where as Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives. Okay, this is Matthew 24, when he's about to deliver what's sometimes called the Olivet Discourse. But Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives and his disciples came to him. Now, I mention that because there's five teaching sections in Matthew's gospel. There's other times when Jesus is doing some teaching, but Matthew has compiled his gospel around five major teaching blocks, if you like. And on three of them, Jesus sits in order to teach. The two that intersperse that, so we've got 5, 13 and 24, in fact, you could say that really starts in 23, where he's teaching things. But in between them, we get chapter 10 and chapter 18. So moving the sort of story on a little bit, if you now turn to chapter 10 and verse 1, there's another mention of authority. He isn't sitting at this point because something else is going to happen. This is not him sitting and teaching. But what's the reference about authority in chapter 10 and verse 1?
He gave them power over unclean spirits.
Oh, you've got the word power, have you? Okay. But in some cases, you'll have the word authority there. So this is different because Jesus is now giving or passing on some authority, but for what purpose in chapter 10? In general, that is.
Isn't it healing?
Well, it was all the healing, yes. Things like that. In other words, what? They've got someone coming in. Is that John and Lynn?
Casting out unclean spirits.
Yeah. Well, basically, we've got someone else. John, another John. There's so many Johns, so it's going to get confusing. John and Hillary, then.
To show them that the kingdom of God was coming.
Yes.
And the man of God preached the gospel.
Yeah. Okay. And there's someone else. Someone, Sally, is it?
He came to, you know, bring healing, release, and deliverance.
Yes.
And freedom for the captives.
Okay. Now you could have summed all that up by saying to do exactly what Jesus had been doing. Okay. That's the point. And remember, one of the big things I was saying last time is a rabbi trained his disciples eventually to imitate him, not just to listen to him, not just to repeat his teaching, but to go out and do what they had seen their rabbi do. And now at this point in the gospel, this is the big moment. Okay, they're being trained, they're apprentices. Now's their chance to go out and put into practice and then report back and say, well, how's it been going, and what should we do differently, and so on. But this is the moment in which they are to start to do what their rabbi has done, and he gives them authority to do that. Now, in some ways, this is all heading towards the climax in Matthew's gospel, which we'll turn to now at the very end, Matthew 28. Again, all of these passages are familiar. I'm just trying to pinpoint a few more things and put them together in a certain way. But right at the end, you know that Jesus said to them, go and make disciples of all nations, what we call the Great Commission. And again, this was typical. Rabbis created disciples who would become teachers themselves to make more disciples, and so on and so on. Like we said, this sort of chain of authority. So there's nothing unusual about the end product being, therefore, go and make more disciples. But there are some significant differences here, and I'll come back to the idea of authority in a minute. But the first little thing to say is where this actually happened. And of course, it was in Galilee. It says in verse 16, they went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. And I mention this because I hadn't really picked this up myself before. The mountain where Jesus had told them to go, that means it's very early on after his resurrection. It's one of the things that they were told to do, go to Galilee, and you know that's where you'll see him. I used to think this was towards the end of that period. This was almost his final words, but of course the ascension was at Olivet, Mount of Olives near Jerusalem. So this wasn't the last thing he told them, otherwise it would have been in that section. He told them this perhaps quite early on in those 40 days. That's just one little thing. The other thing to make clear, when you read, therefore, go and make, it might give you the impression that there's a sort of double command going on here. There's two things that we are ordered to do, what we call imperatives in the sort of language of it, the verbs. But actually, there is only one command here, not two. And the verb that's in that form is the word make. So that's the crucial thing that we are being told to do, is to make disciples. The word go isn't in that form. It's more like a participle, and it could be better translated as something like as you go, or in your going, or even I've seen it somewhere as having gone. In other words, you're not being told to go somewhere. It's just that as you go about wherever you're going, your normal life maybe, then this is what you do. You make disciples wherever you go. It's not just a missionary call. It's not about long distance travel. It's take the opportunities to make disciples as and when, wherever you go, sort of thing. So it doesn't exclude anyone. Now, these disciples, of course, were going to go to the ends of the earth. So perhaps that's why we try and think this is a call to overseas missionary work or something. But it is a call to anybody to wherever you go, wherever you are, you make disciples. But I want to come back to the authority business and see if you can dig this out for yourself here. It does say something in this section about authority, but I wonder if you can spot what the point of that is. Have a look and tell me what you think.
Was it verse 18?
Yeah.
All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth.
Okay, good. But yeah. what's the implication of that? Or put another way, what isn't he saying compared to before?
It's not his authority, it's the authority that's been given to him.
Oh, well, okay. That you could say that means it's the Father again. Mm. Okay. I still want to sort of say that means it is, if it's been given to him, it becomes his. okay. But whose isn't it? What doesn't
it's
happen?
Not, it's not theirs. It's
he
not
doesn't given. Give it to his disciples. Okay. In chapter 10, he gave them authority. He's in this occasion, although he's doing what everybody would expect him to do, tell his disciples to make more disciples, he is not passing on his authority that would normally have happened, like I've said, when a rabbi says, now you go and you've got my authority to do this, and so on. Now, there's two good reasons for that. One is actually, well, tied in with the rest of it, he isn't actually really leaving them, because he says, I'm with you always to the very end of the earth. So it's not as though he's like a normal man, he's going to die and leave them and his authority is passed on. Instead of giving them his authority, he is giving them the promise of his continual presence instead. But the authority remains with him. He's not giving them any authority of their own. But he is promising that when they do this, he's going to be with them. Now, I want to turn you back to another bit that links in with this. So now go back to Matthew 23. And in Matthew 23, we've got verses 8 and 10, and I'll put 9 in there as well, obviously. And this is a verse which used to puzzle me a little bit. I sort of understood it, but I wondered quite what Jesus was getting at. And now I think I know. So Matthew 23, verses 8 and 9 and 10. This is where he says, you are not to be called rabbi. You've only one master and you're all brothers. And then he says the same thing about not being called father. And in verse 10, nor are you to be called teacher, for you have one teacher, Christ. And I thought, well, okay, but he wants them to be teachers, doesn't he? Of course. And so on. So what's he getting at here? And I thought, well, it's just a matter of sort of, he doesn't want them going around showing off and saying, oh, I'm a rabbi, I'm a teacher, and it's fair enough. But I think this ties in with what he's saying here about you've only got one teacher, one master. He's actually saying you're not going to make any disciples for yourself. You're going to make more disciples for me. Because normally a rabbi made disciples and those disciples made their own disciples afterwards. And he's not giving them that authority and he's not even giving them that sense of that's what their role is. What they have to bear in mind all the time is you've only got one master, one teacher. And we could say that when he uses the word father, because if you remember, the rabbi-discipleship relationship was like father-son, he's pretty much saying the same sort of thing. I want to put it another way. He's actually saying, when you go out and do all this, I don't want to end up finding that there is now a school of Peter, a school of John, a school of whatever. You're not making disciples for yourselves. You're making more disciples for me. And that was one of the big differences that he wants. And of course, in particular, yes, they're to pass on his teaching, but they're to teach them to obey everything, i.e. to do what I have commanded you. Now, does that make sense? Anyone want to make a comment on it before I perhaps add a little bit more about that? Betty?
Yes, and Paul picked up on that point, didn't he, when in one of his letters when he was saying about some of you say that I'm your teacher and some say Apollo is your teacher.
Well, exactly, and I was going to pick up on that, but I'll mention it now. You probably know it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he says, one of you says, I follow Paul, another I follow Apollos, another I follow Cephas, another I follow Christ. And again, if you remember that that word follow is specifically about discipleship, then what's going on in Corinth, which is causing all the division and confusion, is that people seem to be saying, yeah, he's my rabbi, instead of becoming disciples of Jesus himself. So, yeah, that's a good point. Pat, next, perhaps.
It's just that if his presence is going with them, then, you know, there is no need for another. Sorry.
Yeah, there's no need for...
they are Jesus's disciples.
Yes.
And his presence is there, so it's an ongoing thing.
Yes. And that's the way it was always meant to be from that point onwards. And we'll think in a minute perhaps why it hasn't always been like that. We'll go for Rhiannon and then Mary.
Yeah, I wondered, did he say it in order to ensure that there wouldn't be division? That's all, yeah.
Yeah, and that is a good point. As I said, he didn't want them to go around making their own disciples or schools and so on. Who was it, Mary?
I was thinking that this is proving that we shouldn't have any hierarchy in the church.
Well, thank you. I'm coming to the point now that, of course, it's very easy, and we keep doing it, where people do set themselves up in order to get their own following. And indeed, people like to have human followers, don't they? You know, they do attach themselves to people. So it sort of works both ways, works badly both ways, if you like. But yes, it does happen. And this is almost the warning to say, that's not the best way. And in fact, Jesus' point is that you're only going to know my presence about making disciples if you are doing it the way I want, which is making more disciples of me. Jesus is not authorizing anything else. So people may go around and build up their own followings and big ministries and all the rest of it, thinking perhaps they're fulfilling the Great Commission, but they're not if they haven't understood this crucially important point. And I'm not saying everybody does that, of course, but it works the other way. As I say, we all like to follow human leaders and assume that that's what Jesus wants. Well, you know, we have to work that through. Is there anyone else at this point? See any other hands up? Karen, are you trying to come in here? Or is it just your pen that's waving around? It looks like... Oh, go on then. I think you're in now.
You switched it off again. Sorry, Karen,
Yes,
it's going to stay up this time, hooray. Mine actually says leader rather than teacher. Mine says, do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ.
Oh, okay.
That actually says that's okay. Bold and clear church today, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the principle would apply, of course, to all of this sort of things. Yeah, okay. But it comes back to what I said last time about Paul. Paul was very clear on this. You imitate me because I imitate Jesus. So, you know, he was making disciples, but he wasn't wanting disciples of himself. He was wanting disciples of Jesus in all that. And that's where I want to sort of leave this idea of authority at this point, where Jesus got his authority from, the reactions that came from it, what he did give to his disciples, but also what he didn't, and how when we are thinking about how we serve and minister they could make disciples or whatever, we need to realize that it's not because we've been given some authority ourselves. We don't have any authority. And that's why we're not meant to teach anything new. See, that's why if people go around still saying, oh, I've got this new thing and this new thing here, you've got to be very careful about that. And we can be very clear and feel safe that everything you read in the New Testament was based upon disciples who understood this, and therefore they have not written or taught anything in the rest of the scriptures that is just of themselves. Okay, they are following this idea through. So from that point of view, everything in our scriptures is under the authority of Jesus. We can teach that from that point of view. Okay, so we've sort of reached the halfway point. Any final thoughts on what I've said, or generally on authority? John and Rose again.
Just to thank you for that point, those points. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and thank you. And it's, I've understood that because I was sort of studying this myself and it became so much clearer. So what I sort of, you think, oh yes, it's got to be like that. That's the way it should be. I now feel much secure, more secure about that, because I think this is from the scriptures what it's about. So so two more, John and Hilary next, is it? And then someone else.
I was just going to say that one of the things that gave Jesus the authority that he did have was he said he was going to do something. So he said he had the authority to forgive sins, and then he did forgive sins on the cross. You know, he told us to go and love one another, and he lived that out in his entire life. He did what he said he would do.
Exactly, because that completely destroys any authority if you don't do things like that. Yeah. We've got more now. Who have we got? Jackie again, and then I think I saw Anita somewhere. Jackie?
Sorry, I think somebody else was before me, but anyway. So I'm just trying to make sure I've got this 100% clear in my head. So in Matthew 10, Jesus gives his disciples authority to do what he's doing. And then in Matthew 28, he says, right, go out and make disciples like me. I'm clear on that. So does that mean we have, what kind of authority do we have? Because I've heard people quoting all sorts of scriptures saying we've got, Jesus has got all authority, we're his disciples, therefore we've got all authority. So I'm just making sure I'm crystal clear on this.
Yeah, well, if you like, then yes, I am pinning this down on the whole teaching side of it, where the only authority we have is to teach what Jesus himself taught, or what he taught through these immediate disciples and so on. He did give authority. One thing I'm going to have to perhaps keep saying in all this is, once you get past Pentecost, we have the Holy Spirit. So this won't come through in the gospel accounts in the same way, because although the Holy Spirit was around, Jesus eventually was going to give us the Holy Spirit in a new way. And therefore, there is that kind of authority that he gives. So if you're thinking about ministry, again, things to do with healing and so on, then the power or authority to do that, and someone said it was power in Matthew 10, that comes from the Holy Spirit. That's our way of knowing that we have authority from Jesus to do those other things. But Matthew 28, I think, is more about the making disciples, teaching them to obey, and so on. So I don't know if that has made it clearer, or whether it's just fudged the fact that there does seem to be more than one thing going on. But do you want to come back on that at all? Jackie, is there anything still about that which...
No, it's fine. It's just, I was just making crystal clear in my head that I had understood exactly what you said.
Well, yeah, I think that's the limit of what I can say on that. I've got someone out. Anita, next then.
Yeah, it's me. Yeah. Paul, I just want to add my thanks along with John Jenks, in that the clarity about Jesus being the only rabbi and teacher is very clear. So I'm just thinking, with this kind of clarity, it just points to a Hebraic model rather than the Greek model. So it's God-centered rather than man-centered.
He doesn't say how you're meant to do it, but certainly to start with, it was meant to be in the same way. I mean, as long as you're teaching people to do the things that Jesus said you should do, then you're doing it okay, I guess. But the more Hebraic you are, the more you're likely to do it the right way, I guess. So yeah, thanks. We have got two more, then we'll move on. Mary and Betty, and then we will move on.
Eleanor as well.
Oh, is there? Sorry, I didn't see that, but go on. Mary, next. You're muted, though.
I didn't have any other questions. I'm sorry. Was my still up? I don't know.
Okay, well, you are, yeah. So who's next then, Christine?
Betty and then Eleanor.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to tackle this one, Paul. It's really picking up on Jackie's points. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear.
Yeah. Picking up on Jackie's point with the, and I understand things changed at Pentecost. My word, didn't they change? But wasn't the reason that Jesus said, I have to go to my Father so I can send the Comforter, I can send the Holy Spirit to you. Mm. So in that way, he is still with us.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't take any more than that from it. And presumably then we're given gifts to do these other things as he...
I'm just pointing out that then becomes the authority for some of these other things.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I was just wanting to clarify that, you know, I've got it right. Thank you.
Okay.
Eleanor,
and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Paul, for your explanation of Matthew 28:19, because I was always led to believe it was going and making disciples, which almost abdicates ordinary people in a way. But I think the way you've described it, it gives us all the incentive to do what we do right where we are.
Yeah.
And that's really liberating, I think. So thank you very much for that.
It can mean just go next door almost. But
blossom where you're planted almost, isn't it, really?
Oh, yeah. I think if you check it out in other versions, particularly the more literal versions, or because, I mean, understanding exactly what's going on in the Greek is a different thing. But that's why I've seen it sometimes, having gone or on your as you're going and things like that. And I did find that someone agreed with me on the on this point, someone who knew Greek a bit better.
Okay. Yes, so thank you very much for that.
Let's move on to Luke 14:26. And as I said, I'd be doing this when it sort of cropped up a little bit last time. And this may actually be the only other thing we focus on, because I think, again, you will find quite a few things to talk about. So Luke 14:26. So I'm tackling here the bit where Jesus says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters and so on, then he cannot be my disciple. So some of you might be aware of what I'm going to say here, but I've got to try and explain this strange phrase that he uses. This is one of these idioms, one of these very Jewish things that don't make a lot of sense necessarily when we just translate it straight away into English. The first problem we have with that is that it seems to contradict things like the Ten Commandments, which tells us to honour our father and mother. And later on, we know that in the New Testament, Paul and maybe others say things about husband loving your wives and all the rest of it. And yes, we know that it's costly being a disciple of Jesus, but this really does seem to be going a bit far if we got to end up hating members of our family. Now, it's worth pointing out that in the other place where this is mentioned, which is in Matthew 10:33, so find that as well, but keep your fingers in Luke 14:26. Matthew 10:37, Jesus says the same sort of thing, but he changes, or there is a slight change to the wording of it. Someone like to tell us what you find there that's might seem to be helping us, illuminating it.
It's comparison.
John and Hilary?
Yeah, I was going to say that. It's a priority, isn't it? It's just where you put your priorities. It's
yes, okay. But in the Matthew verse, then how is it put? The word hate isn't there. It says?
Loves more.
Love more, yes. Love more than me. Okay. But it's the same thing. If you do that, it makes us unworthy of being his disciple. Now, again, I'm not sure that completely explains everything, because you can still say something like, I love my wife more than I love my cat, and it doesn't mean you hate your cat. So to say you hate something still seems to be a bit too excessive, until you realise, as indeed you've just been saying, that in Hebrew expressions, to love and to hate, when they're together, is not about emotions, it's about choices. So it's about the will, not the heart. And put it simply, to love means to put first, to hate means to put second. So if I can say this in the fact that it's to do with father, mother, wife, children, and so on, I'm going to say it's all relative, okay? I'm allowed a little amusement there. And it is a matter of your choice as to who you put first. Now, love can still mean love and hate can still mean hate, but in certain contexts, and certainly in comparison, it simply means, as you just said, priority, order, and so on. Now, let's check this out. Firstly, in Malachi. In Malachi chapter 1 and verse 3. Now, it's going to be interesting to see whether your translations pick up on this. So I shall ask for other translations in a minute. Mary, do you need to come in now? Is your hand still up from before? Because you're still muted as well.
Yeah, I did this when you were saying the love-hate thing. You know, it talks about Jacob and Esau.
Yeah. That's what we're now looking at. Okay.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. This is why I've said Malachi 1:3. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you. So what's going on here when it says, and again, the chances are your version will still use these words, I have loved Jacob, but Esau I have hated. So is this some kind of emotional reaction towards these brothers? No, this is about God reiterating his covenant choice. That in the end, of course, Esau may still be loved, but he is not the number one pick when it comes to God's covenant plans and promises. It's with Jacob that he renews the covenants with Abraham and Isaac. So that's another situation in which this love-hate phraseology works out. There's another one back in Genesis. So look at Genesis 29, 31. Now, in Genesis 29, 31, this again is Jacob, but it's to do with his family situation. Because as you know, he married twice. And with Rachel and Leah. Now, what I've got in my version, and this does come through, when the Lord saw that Leah was not loved. Now, that actual word in the Hebrew is still hate, okay? But if you've got that in your translation, she was not loved, that's a way of trying to sort of tone it down a little bit. And so we don't want to say she was hated, we'll just say she was not loved. But actually, that's not true, because she was loved, it's just that she wasn't loved as much as Rachel. In fact, if you read verse 30, it makes that clear. Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. And then it goes on in verse 31, when the Lord saw that Leah was hated. But, you know, it's hated in this loved less situation. And unfortunately, if your Bible has translated it as not loved, it almost sounds as though she wasn't loved at all. And it doesn't mean that at all. Again, it's a comparison thing. She took second place in Jacob's affections. Here's another example in Deuteronomy 21. Deuteronomy chapter 21. And we're looking at verses 15 to 17. Now, in chapter 21, verses 15 to 17, this is mainly about the rights of the firstborn. But it's what happens if you end up in a rather tricky situation that you've got two wives. It doesn't say why you've got two wives. It doesn't say it's a good thing. It just says if a man has two wives. And then again, my version says, and he loves one, but not the other. Actually, again, in Hebrew, it is he loves one and hates the other. But our English translators don't like the idea of using the word hated, so they say not loved. But again, it doesn't mean the second one is not loved. And if you want to follow this little section through at some point, because it fascinates you, the problem being resolved here is what happens if the firstborn is the son of the hated wife rather than the loved wife. The husband will be very tempted to give the birthrights, the firstborn rights, to the firstborn of his loved wife. And God says, no, if your hated wife produces your first son, then he has to have the firstborn rights. So that's what's being sorted out here. But again, it's the translational issue and so on. And that's why when, you know, you come to listening to the Jewish Jesus, you realise that he is speaking in the same way, and he's using hate in the sense of love less. I think there's something similar in Matthew 6:24. And we looked at this last time, or at least we looked at something similar to that. This is the bit where Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. So we're back in Matthew 6 and verse 24. Do you have the phrase after it? Because this time my translation does. No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other. And again, that means he doesn't necessarily have to have some kind of emotional reaction against one of them. It just means he's bound to favour one more than the other. And then he applies it to God and money, or mammon, worldly possessions, pointing out that you cannot love both of those equally. And when we thought last time about the rich young man, the young chap who came to Jesus and said, yes, I'll follow you. And Jesus said, well, you've got to do something about your money first. And he went away sad. And we said we didn't actually know whether he did anything or not. Jesus recognized that his problem was, at this stage, that he loved money and hated God. And he had to get it the other way around. He may have thought he could love both. And Jesus is saying, no, that doesn't work. You're bound to love one more than the other. And if you're not careful, you're going to hate God simply because you love money. So that comes through in so many different things. So we've now understood that, hopefully, that in certain contexts, Hebraically hate is used to mean love less or put second. But that doesn't reduce the degree of commitment that Jesus is actually saying here, and therefore back to the whole idea of family relations, which is now what we're going to pursue. He's still saying in it was Luke, wasn't it? Luke 14, that your family can get in the way, so to speak. That's my interpretation, my phrase. I don't think you'll find that in any translation. So we now need to dig into, now we understand the word hate, the idiom involved in it, what's actually going on here. Now, again, sort of keep your finger in Luke 14, 26, but we'll turn to something else, which I think someone did mention last time. If you want to stay in Luke, it's Luke 8, verses 20 to 21. Luke 8, verses 20 to 21. And I tend to turn to Matthew as well. I go to that gospel more than anything. So it's in Matthew 12, verse 46 to 50. There's perhaps a little bit more in that. So Matthew 12, 46 to 50. And this is the bit where Jesus is busy teaching and his mother and brothers arrive, hoping to see him, or at least to get a word with him, and they're sort of left waiting outside. Okay, so, you know, it just doesn't look like a great scenario here. So Jesus is still talking to the crowds, or he's surrounded by crowds, whichever sort of version you have there. And his family turn up and they want to talk with him. We're not told what they want to talk to him about. We just know that they couldn't get near. And someone eventually passes the word on to Jesus. Look, they're here. And then Jesus says something, which is basically, who are my mother? Who are my brothers? Oh, here they are. Anybody who does the will of the Father, they are my mother and brothers. And I want to highlight, first of all, that if not careful, you can think that Jesus is being rather disrespectful here, that actually he's ignoring his mother and his brothers, can't be bothered, and so on. It can give a bit of a negative impression. But again, if you're not careful, we assume something without thinking what might have happened. And we shouldn't assume that he didn't then talk to them. He may well have gone outside to talk to them. He may well have welcomed them in. It's just that it's not part of the account that we've got. And in fact, he doesn't say he went on for hours teaching them. All he said was this one thing. Who are my mother and brothers? And he points to his disciples and says, it's anybody who obeys the will of the Father. And he's not necessarily excluding them. He's actually saying, well, if they obey the will of my Father, then they're part of this. I've got a wider family. So it's not all negative towards his mother or his brothers, as we'll see again in a minute. But the important thing to get hold of is Jesus is doing here what any rabbi would do, is he takes advantage of the situation that arises. Okay, he didn't plan this. He's busy teaching them. We don't know what he's teaching them. But when the situation changes, he takes the opportunity, and rabbis would always look to do this, and give a teaching based upon it. So he might have been doing something totally different, and it's almost like, oh, before I wrap all this up and we disperse, let me just say this. You also are my brother and my mother. You're part of my family if you do the will of my Father. So that's what he's actually doing. And in fact, it says specifically he pointed to his disciples. And that, again, is a very rabbinic way of teaching to make the point, literally. But rabbis, you don't always get this in the text. You've got to imagine them doing it. But they would point to something to illustrate what they're saying. Okay, so he's not ignoring them as such. He's simply using the opportunity to say, I'm including all of you now in my family if you do the will of my Father, our Father. If we've got a common Father, then you're included as well. So don't think anything too bad is happening here. I'll pick that up a little bit more in a minute, but does anyone want to come in at this stage now that I've explained what I feel is really going on there? John and Hilary again.
Yeah, I was just going to say this is a bit of a turning point in the Gospels, isn't it? Because we did Matthew 10, when Jesus sent all of the disciples out, that you said, you know, with the authority to get rid of unclean spirits and heal every sickness.
Yeah.
And later on in chapter of Matthew 10, Jesus says, only go to the house of Israel. And then we get Matthew 12, and previously to this bit, which you said at the end of Matthew 12, that Jesus performed a miracle which the disciples didn't believe in him. Did he? He cast out the demon from the dumb man, and they said, and the disciples attributed Jesus doing that miracle. Well,
hang on, it's not his disciples that did that, it's the Pharisees.
Pharisees.
It's a different point, and you're quite right, that is the pivotal moment in the whole gospel story, and Matthew actually puts it in the center. I've explained how he does these five teaching sections, but actually he pivots the whole of his gospel around that particular moment. Okay.
Yes. So as you said, sorry, it was the Pharisees that said that.
Yeah, yeah, it's not the disciples. That would be confusing to think that. Let's go to Mary next.
Could I go back to the bit about hating Esau and loving Jacob?
Okay.
I just want to go back to it, because in previous scriptures that you brought up, it was the interpreters had put in unloved, like Leah was unloved and so on. Mm. So why do you think they left the hating bit in Matthew
All I can say is it's an excellent question, and I'm not privy to the mental processes of translation. And of course, there's so many translations anyway. Who knows how they've done it in different ones. I almost do feel that this whole idea of specific idioms, expressions, and so on is something that a lot of translators, at the time when they were translating, just didn't quite have enough information or quite enough understanding. The other point, I don't know if this is true or not, but a lot of translations are done by committee. And so it might be that, you know, one translator did this and one did another and they never really talked to each other. But I'm being a bit cynical there, I think. But, it's a very good point. And we will find this in the New Testament things, that sometimes it seems to become more translated out into better English and other times left in. I can see a hand up. No, there's someone else first. Let me just. John and Jan.
Yep. Jan, you had a point.
Yep.
I'm in trouble on muting. Just going to ask, can I read out the Luke 14:26 from the Amplified version?
Oh yeah, go on.
Sort of explains it fairly well.
Yeah, you're going to read it, say?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, go on.
If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, in the sense of indifference to or relative disregard for them in comparison with his attitude to God, he cannot be my disciple.
Good. Well done, the Amplified, for putting everything in they can think of and making it really clear.
Yeah.
At least I see they haven't given you several different words for father and several different words for mother and so on. But yeah, I mean, that sometimes is where the Amplified comes into its own. It does fill this up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me keep going. I want to follow this a little bit. I wonder if Mary, though, really understood what was happening when... Thanks for the chat, by the way, there. If people want to follow that up, the One New Man Bible from Jackie there. I'll leave you to do that if you want. Having said we now sort of understand where Jesus is coming from in all this, and how really he's just doing what a rabbi does, makes a new point out of it. And I think at that point he just said, right, that's it, end of lesson now. And he ends with that particular bit. And then his mother and brothers come in. Or he goes out to them or something. So he hasn't just sent them away ignoring them or told them they've got to wait outside for another couple of hours. But Mary may still have found it a bit confusing. We know she understood a certain amount of things from the early days when the angel mentioned about the special son she was going to have and so on. But she may still be on a learning curve here as to what it really meant. And the idea of Jesus having a bigger family may have created a bit of tension. I think we know that his brothers didn't believe in Jesus for a long time. They certainly remember the situation where that time they went to the Feast of Tabernacles, it says the disciples didn't, his brothers rather, didn't believe in him at that point. So there might have been a lot of family tension still, about people unsure exactly what Jesus was really doing. And in fact, I wonder how much the mothers and fathers, but mainly the mothers perhaps, of the other disciples felt about their sons being sort of lost to the Jesus mission, if I can put it that way. The disciples were told, you know, we've left everything, don't worry, you'll be rewarded, it's all worth it, and so on. And they might think, oh great, that's fine. But the mothers left at home might have wondered a bit differently. But for Mary, it had a very happy ending, in the sense that, and you can look this up if you want in John 19, but you'll know that at the time of Jesus' crucifixion, when Mary was there, Jesus said to John, behold your mother, and to Mary, behold your son. And he was making sure she was looked after, that she would go to be part of John's household. At that point, if you like, the bigger family aspect of it worked in her favour. Otherwise, she would be totally alone at that point. But now she had a new son in the Apostle John. And just to point something else out, have a look in Acts 1:14. Acts 1:14. I'm sure you know that Mary was there at Pentecost. Mary was eventually part of the discipleship group. And in Acts 1:14, where they're actually at this point in the upper room, it's not yet Pentecost. But again, another little detail that I hadn't noticed till recently, where they're all together in the upper room, constantly in prayer, along with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. I hadn't noticed that before, but at this point, his mother and all his brothers were now part of his wider family, and they were then about to receive the Spirit and go on in that sort of way. So it might have been a bit tense at the time, but it all played out in the end. Now, in that little Luke 14:26 thing, it talks not just about mothers and fathers. What else did it talk about? Brothers and sisters. Just lost it for a moment. Wife and children. What about the wife of a disciple? What does she have to put up with? Well, we said that most disciples were quite young. Often they were called straight out of the education system or very soon after that. And we know that a lot of Jesus' disciples were young lads. But of course, young lads married quite young in those days, usually by about the age of 18. And we know that Peter was certainly married. That comes through in so on. So here's another possible source of conflict. If you were already married, what would you have to do? Obviously, you would have to put your wife second compared to your rabbi. And in the Mishnah, that's one, that's that strange collection of eventually written down stuff from the oral traditions of the time. So in other words, it wasn't in writing at Jesus's time, but there's lots of things in there which tell us things that are useful. The Mishnah actually says that a disciple could be absent from his home for up to could be absent from his home for up to 30 days to study with a rabbi, even against the will of his wife. Bad luck. Then it says, after that, he needs her permission. Wonderful. Anyway, I'm going off there for 30 days. I'm going to study with my rabbi. So look after the young one, you know, make sure everything's okay there. Can I stay an extra day? No. Okay. So that's the ruling that they seem to come to. And there's something else in the Mishnah, which I'll paraphrase it rather than quote it, but it's quite astonishing. We've said about how the rabbi was like your new father and you've been trained to be like him and so on. And it says in certain cases, your rabbi has to be esteemed above your own father. If both your father and your rabbi have lost something or are both bearing a burden, whatever that might be, then you should attend to the needs of your rabbi first. And if both are taken captive, you are to ransom your rabbi first and your father second. Now, there's an example of hating, isn't it? Now, I've got no idea what it means to be taken captive or what kind of ransom would happen here. But if by some strange coincidence, they're both captured and you're faced with the awful choice of deciding who to ransom first, well, you love your rabbi and you hate your father, apparently, in that new sense that we know about. There is an exception, the Mishnah goes on. If your father is also a teacher, then you could put him first. And the reason they give is that, well, your natural father, all he's done is brought you into this world. But your rabbi is giving you the wisdom to enable you to enter into the world to come. Well, whether you think that's good or not, but it tells you what's happening. It might still feel a bit sort of shocking to us, but the whole point about the discipleship thing is you can't be halfway in. We discussed that last time. I won't look this up, but do you remember how the relationship between Elijah and Elisha was one of father and son? And in fact, they date back to this time, the whole idea of the father-son relationship between a rabbi and a disciple. You may remember when Elijah is leaving, he's going up in the whirlwind. Elisha cries out, "My father, my father." He regards Elijah as his father in that sense. And the prophets they were training, it might in some translations say the company of the prophets, but actually it says the sons of the prophets, in the same way as disciples were sons of a rabbi. So there's a sort of long tradition on that. One other point on Luke 14:26, which we can't ignore, is that as well as hating all these family members, it does add, yes, even his own life. Yes, even his own life. But again, now we know that Jesus is not telling us to engage in self-loathing or to count our lives as worthless. It's rather to put ourselves and our self-interest second to the demands of discipleship. I've got a couple more points and then we'll finish. So we'll have to leave the third thing to next time. Does anyone want to say anything now before I say these final two things that I've got here? Anyone want to come in with anything at this point? Any wise want to comment upon the awfulness of the Mishnah? Pat?
It's just a question, actually. Paul and his travels and everything. I mean, he would have been away for more than 30 days.
Yeah, and now I'll be sure he's married. That's one of these debating points. Sometimes, does he talk as though he is? I don't know. I sometimes think... John and Jan, are you coming in on this point, the same point?
Or even Peter, because he was travelling as well. Was he away for more?
Well, he probably was allowed to pop home from time to time, particularly when they're in the Galilee. And in fact, that's how we know he's married, because Jesus was there with him. Yeah. So, John and Jan?
Chris Hill reckons that Paul was married because he had to be married to be part of the Sanhedrin.
Oh, okay. And... Was he still married, do you think? Or I don't think there's any direct reference to his wife, but this is a fair assumption. So but I don't.
If he'd followed Christ, become a Christian,
yeah,
his wife could have kicked him out and gone back to her family.
Well, okay.
And therefore, he was married to be part of the Sanhedrin, but not.
Okay.
Effectively, at other.
Yes. So, and also probably well, within...
Paul say about not taking a wife along with him, which some of you have, and it's impossible that Peter took his wife. There was nothing, I mean, there was a lot of women following them because they were doing all the cooking, etc.
yes, okay. Yes, she's not specifically mentioned as such, we don't even know her name, but it's certainly quite possible that afterwards... when, by afterwards, I mean, after the resurrection, after Pentecost, that she would have joined in as well. Yeah, perfectly possible. Let's take Val next, please.
Val. I was just going to say, what happens if a woman wants to become a disciple of the rabbi?
Well, I don't think women became proper disciples in that sense. That's what we learn about other women who did follow. So, yes, there will be... I think Jesus was probably a bit exceptional here, that he did, allow these women to be part of his group, shall we say. But I don't think they were probably called to be disciples in the same...
Would they have left their children with the in-laws or the granny and grandpas? Or?
I don't know. Beyond anything I've ever looked at. Sue?
Going back to hating a life, I've just reminded of Luke 9, when Jesus said, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will save it.
Yeah, okay. I'll say my other two things, and then you can come back on that. And this is me just speculating a little bit again, and people might know a bit more of this and want to come into it. But one of the reasons I think this is so strongly mentioned here, and is a key part, is that, of course, our fathers and mothers, brothers and sisters, our immediate family members, are the ones who have most influenced us as we've grown up. Our family ties in that sense, have determined a lot about our habits, our attitudes, maybe even our personality, and so on. They're initially formed within this particular family group. And there's a sort of umbilical cord of attachment that's there, which may not be helpful in then the following of a rabbi who is then trying to make you imitate him and become in his own image. So there would be a sort of clash here about perhaps the way you've been brought up and the sort of person you've become because of that, compared to what the rabbi is then expected to do. And that might be one of the reasons why some rabbis sent their disciples away in the end. It's almost like, no, your family ties are too strong. You're still holding on to those. It's not fair expecting me to change you into the sort of person that you need to be. And therefore, what seems to be happening here is that rather than allow these old relationships to deflect us from this new path of following Jesus, what we've got to do is this delicate balance between renouncing their influence and maybe their ways, but not in the sense of literally hating or reviling, and still loving and honouring them. And maybe that's a little bit what Jesus meant when he said, I actually brought a sword into these situations, and I'm turning this person against that and so on. And the idea that you've got to be cut loose so that you can still love your family and honour them, but not let them influence you anymore once you're in a discipleship relationship. Now, that's me going beyond any kind of sort of understanding I've got on the psychology of it all and the pastoral implications and so on. But I just wonder if that comes out of the text as well. And the final bit, I want to turn to John 21. And I would have done more on this if time hadn't run away, of course. So this will be where we'll pick it up next time, back in this chapter, John 21. But I think we have to consider the words of Jesus to Peter towards the end of the gospel here, from verse 15 onwards. I think you know the scene quite well. But Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more? Do you love me more than these? And Jesus is provoking him with this question along the lines of, who do you love more? Okay. Now, there's some debate as to what the word these means, and that's where it'd be wonderful if we're there. We might see him pointing again, or we might at least see him looking in a certain direction. Some people have suggested that the these refers to the other disciples. Do you love me more than they do? Particularly as Peter had earlier boasted that, oh, they'll all fall away, but I won't. And now he's sort of humble enough to recognise that he can't say anymore that he does love Jesus more than the others do. The other scenario is that when he says these, and what he might be pointing to is, of course, the boats, the fish, everything that's part of his past life and so on. And perhaps he's actually saying, you know, do you love me more than everything about your life? Not comparing Peter with the other disciples, but comparing him to everything he already knows. And the final point on this, at this point, before I leave it, is it's a good job Peter said what he did say, even if you might think it was a bit tentative. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Because otherwise, if he'd have said, oh no, I love them more than that, he would have effectively been saying that he hated Jesus. And we wouldn't want to have read it like that, would we? But that's part of a wonderful chapter, and I've got more to say on that, but I will have to leave that as it ties into a bigger topic that I want to pick up next time. So any final thoughts, comments, questions on anything that I've said? I see someone's put a chat about, Paul in Corinthians saying it's good for them to stay unmarried as I am. And that fits in with the fact that he might be unmarried now, but he might have been married and his wife might have died and something like that. So that sort of leaves us a bit. I think we've got Miriam coming in and then one or two others I can see.
Yeah, I'm just jumping back to Matthew. Yeah. You mentioned about the pivotal point in Matthew, and I didn't catch what you said was the pivotal point.
Okay, well, it's not the main point of what we're talking about at the moment. But It's in Matthew 12, and it is the moment when Jesus does a particular healing of a deaf and dumb man, and he's accused of doing it through the power of the devil, basically. And once you start to see the works of God and say that that's the devil at work, then, well, in that scenario, that means that Jesus could not be the Messiah. In other words, that was the moment of his national rejection as Messiah. Now, we know that was always going to happen. That was never, you know, the plan. He was going to be rejected and so on. But there had to come an actual point within the gospel story, within the, you know, the history of it, where his messiahship was then officially rejected. Mm-hmm. And it is at that point, and there's a whole load more to say about that, which I might come back to at some point if it's relevant to, you know, looking at things that he said.
Okay, thank you.
I've only planned a couple of weeks ahead. I don't know how long this is going to take me. But given my absolute love for Matthew's gospel, anything you ask me about Matthew's gospel, I'm going to want to do it. So we've got Val and Mary that I can see. Should we do Mary first, as you're unmuted?
I just want to pick up on what the other lady said about this was the pivotal point when it was accused of being the follower of Beelzebub kind of thing, because I had someone teaching that's the point where he really started to concentrate on his disciples, teaching them.
Yeah.
And that was the point.
Well, you may have heard me say that, actually, because I certainly
did. Oh, maybe I did.
and that's why it might be a good thing to say. And that's why in Matthew 13, Jesus starts to teach differently using parables.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're going to look at parables and why he changed tack at that point. But yes, that it's a pivotal moment in every way, and that includes the
amen.
I mean, he knows now that it's not worth bothering with these people, and he does start to train his disciples more intensely, if you like. Val?
I'm sorry, I put my hand up by mistake.
Okay.
Eleanor.
When you were speaking, Paul, when you were speaking of the rabbi and training their disciples to become like them, it made me think about the way God works in us with the power of the Holy Spirit, bringing about inner transformation so that we imitate Jesus.
Indeed, and that's something that I've made a note of, and what I said earlier about we have to realise that it's fascinating going to the Gospels and listening to Jesus and so on, but for us we are post-Pentecost and they were pre. And it's the same idea, but it's slightly different. I say this time and again, it surprises people. When you read the Gospels, you're not yet in New Covenant times, because the New Covenant is the death and resurrection of Jesus, not his birth. So everything in the Gospel, you're in a sort of transition stage, because Jesus is there. But the New Covenant, of course, doesn't come in until Jesus has died. And then you get the Holy Spirit. So we're still reading things that are, if you like, beyond our situation. And yes, the key difference will be the Holy Spirit then comes for that same purpose. What did Jesus say? I'll send you the Holy Spirit to lead you into all truth. He will teach you, and so on. But of course, it's still Jesus teaching us. And it's the only way he can teach sort of millions of people at the same time and sort of be at our meeting tonight and at someone else's meeting the same night and the next night and so on. He now operates in that different way. We move it on into our New Covenant time as well.
Thank you.
Now, Val's got a hand up again, which makes me wonder whether this time... Yes, I think so. Yes?
No, I'm sorry. I don't know how to stop. I'm pressing on something. Sorry, June.
Okay, never mind. And the truth is, when you do put it up genuinely, we won't know this time. John and Rose.
It really is quite remarkable how Jesus was able to disciple his disciples ahead of them on really understanding what they were being discipled for.
Then,
you know, once it happened, it all just fell into place almost.
Yeah.
Like, okay, there's some work, there was 40 days of work to do, if you like.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, they could then see, as it clearly when Peter stands up, they knew what was going on and how it all hung together.
That is a good point. And as you were saying that, I was thinking exactly the same thing, that those 40 days then become quite significant. And I used to think, oh, I wish I knew what Jesus taught them in those 40 days. Why haven't we got that? Why isn't there another book between the Gospels and the book of Acts? But actually, we do have that because it's what they then went on to teach anyway. And also it is reflected back in the Gospel accounts. And we can get it from the Gospel accounts. And they didn't, because we've got the later stuff and we're seeing it from a distance and in retrospect and so on. But that 40 days were essential to what Jesus needed to do to prepare his disciples still further. And then the Holy Spirit coming in to
very much part of that.
Yeah. Do we have anybody else at this point? John and Jan again?
Got it this time. Going back to John and him, Jesus asking Peter, do you love me more than these?
Yeah.
I've always taken it to be the boats and the nets, etc.
Oh, interesting.
Because if you go back to the start of that chapter, you've got Peter and the other disciples wandering by the lake, and Peter effectively says, I'm going fishing. You coming? Yeah, we'll come.
Yeah.
They go off out for the night and they don't catch anything.
Yeah.
And then there's the scenario with Jesus, which ends up with him saying,
yeah,
love me more than these. You know, time to make your choice.
But yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You get these sort of ambiguities in the fact that a word like these can mean different things. I've heard it sort of expressed in both ways. But also I've heard it strongly said, Jesus would never ask Peter if he loved him more than the other disciples did. He would not want to set up a confrontation like that. And it is more likely that he's saying the boats and the fish. But I've sort of come to that second, and I'm thinking that might be the best. But I'll tell you next week, within the context of another section of teaching, more about that chapter, and answer the question, why did Peter go fishing anyway? What made him go out in the boats that night? That's an interesting question, and it ties in with something else. So that's part of next time.
Jackie has a question.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
It was just a comment again to say that it talks about the agapo and the filial love, the different ones, and I think that helps to clarify it, but I won't say anything in case you're doing that next week.
Well, it's not the main thing I'm going to do, but yes, you're absolutely right. And I'd love it when I hear someone teach on this chapter, because they've always got that to bring out. There's all of Peter's feelings. There's the setting and everything. So, but we'll save that for next week and bring it back in again. But Jesus is choosing his words very, very carefully. And just to reiterate what you said, Jesus uses agape, doesn't he? And Peter uses philo or philia, whatever it is. So Jesus is asking him strongly, and Peter is very humbly saying, well, yes, I do love you, but I can't claim agape love, that sort of thing.
Well, I've got Peter being asked, do you agapo me? Do you agapo me? Do you filio me?
Ah, that's right. Yeah, the third
and
time.
His answer is, yes, I filio you. Yes, I filio. Yes, I filio you.
Yeah, and that's why it might say, and Peter was hurt the third time, because Jesus changes the word.
Yeah.
But there might be other reasons why he's hurt. And there's actually a lot more going on in that particular passage than I ever realised until I came to do these studies again and look at this whole rabbi-disciple thing. But again, that's for next time. And I see people already sort of leaving the meeting as the numbers are coming down. So I've obviously spent my time.
Yeah, really interesting.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.